Off the Ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
I'm prepared to anything I can.
Well,
to
do it then.
Again.
Do it then. What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should have an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Welcome along to the Football Show. We are live on the radio. We are also live in our TV studio on Facebook, Twitter, Periscope, offtheball.com. You'll find us as well. We are here. You can see us. Me, Joe Molloy, as it says there on the screen. And you, Dan McDonald.
Hello. How are
very
things?
Welcome. So on the Football Show this evening, Raphael Honigstein will join us very shortly to talk Jurgen Klopp, who... got a bit of a tune out of his team.
Good weekend.
Yeah, very good weekend. We didn't talk much about this game yesterday, given the remnants of the O'Neill stain story now. Stay-in, not stain.
Stain, but a stain. I think that's a Freudian, I think they call it, Joe.
Stain story. So we'll talk to Raphael Honigstein very shortly. He wrote a book about Jurgen Klopp. Spoke to a lot of people who'd worked with Klopp down the years. We didn't talk to Rafa about that book yet. So we'll tie both those things in as we still reflect on Liverpool's win over Manchester City. And then Miguel Delaney will join us because it does certainly seem that Sanchez is going to Old Trafford. We're not 100% sure yet if Mkhitaryan is going the other way. This deal is moving along more slowly, perhaps, than we might have expected. Manchester City are definitely out. We know that. So Miguel will give us the very latest on that deal. Sanchez to Manchester United would strike me as good business for Manchester United.
Yeah, I think in their current state... I may say the current state makes it sound like they're in some kind of grim state. Sorry, but you know,
it's not a great state.
When you consider what Jose before Christmas was openly complaining, I guess, for want of a better term, or making it known that they felt they could be spending some more, even though they'd spent quite a lot already. I think if you can get someone, for all maybe some of his character traits that we might discuss later on, is still a sort of an elite, a premium level, I guess, Premier League player. So if you can bring someone like that in where you're not necessarily concerned about how he adapts to England or adapts to the league, there's no gamble there. I mean, there is an element of a gamble there, of course, but it's a safer bet maybe than going outside to someone who might need to adapt, particularly for a January sale. Like the January sale touched on a bit earlier on, you pay a bit more, but generally that's because the shoppers are a bit more desperate. I mean, Chelsea are going after Andy Carroll. You know, it's a product of January.
Are they?
Oh yeah, I mean, you obviously weren't listening to Richie there during the news as he mentioned this fact.
That.
Yeah, it sort of passed me by a small bit as well, I have to say, with the O'Neill thing the last few days. I sort of, just earlier on, sort of listening to this, hang on, what's happening here? Yeah. But Chelsea were linked with a loan move for Andy Carroll, which seemed a bit more plausible as an emergency. But now the latest discussion is that it may actually be a permanent deal, that they have to meet West Ham's valuation of the player.
Which is? What is Andy
Carroll
worth?
I'm not sure what the figure actually is, but I mean, they're probably going to recoup. Did they pay around 15 million for him or something like that, I think? Mm-hmm. Which was obviously a cut price from what Liverpool spent, but then you're talking about Premier League inflation.
Yeah,
so,
if
what is a Carroll worth anymore?
Well, if Coutinho is worth 140 million, then what is Andy Carroll worth?
Yeah, this is a thing. And like, is there no players left in the Premier League? It's almost like Andy Carroll has become a playing version of the Tony Pulis or the Big Sam, or it is the tried and trusted. Chelsea need an alternative to Morata. Batshuayi doesn't seem to have necessarily worked, or he's been a bit underwhelming anyway.
Yeah.
And it seems that maybe, again, in January, you have the odd elite level player like Sanchez available, but otherwise, you know, the superstars that are going to move in January, it's more likely a summer as a window you're going to find your next star.
If Carroll goes for more than 35 million, I think we should just both resign.
I'm not sure if it's about that, but like, what a career he's sort of having. It's like these sort of periods at sort of West Ham and Newcastle interspersed with the odd top six move, top four move. I mean, it's a remarkable feat to do what he's done with his career.
The other news, of course, over the last 24 hours is the Ryan Giggs story. He did his press conference, his opening press conference, which was really quite a negative one, you were saying, on the whole. You would think this should be a good story. It's an easy sell, presumably, even though Giggs did miss 18 friendlies in a row. I was saying to you in the news round that they did a vox pop on the BBC Wales, and the three or four responses were, one, he's got no experience, said one person. One woman very pointedly said, well, he's not a role model.
No.
And just stared down the camera. You know what I mean?
It's sort of funny. It sort of goes unsaid. You don't even need to explain. It's just like, okay.
Yeah, that's fair. Okay,
that
fair enough.
Area.
Yeah,
okay.
And then someone said he plays fast football and someone said he plays fast football. We don't know what he does. And someone said, well, he's Welsh. So, but so it wasn't overwhelming and it was put to gigs in the press conference. You know, what have you made of the social media backlash, Ryan? And he said, well, I'm not a social media person for that very reason, which might be best practice. We played a clip earlier on. A lot of people, I think, judging by Twitter, have since watched the Life of Ryan documentary we mentioned.
Yeah, I sort of feel like I want to go and do it now, to be honest, because I feel slightly underprepared to discuss the nuances of it. We're judging off this team talk clip, if people haven't heard it.
Southampton won. Manchester United won was the final game of the Ryan Giggs Manchester United era when David Moyes was sacked 2014. So one of the standout scenes is the Ryan Giggs team talk, rousing team talk to the Manchester United players before the last game of the season.
Team today, you're going to have to work hard because these work the bollocks off and they're good at home. But the team that we've got experience, we've got pace, we've got players who are comfortable on the ball. They do die at the end. So, subs, you might come on and win the game. So concentrate, watch the game. But it's last game of the season. We want to end on a high. We want to give our fans something to shout about. City or Liverpool are going to win the league. Give our fans something to shout about. It's been a frustrating season, but it's a good game to play in and one that I'm looking forward to because of the exciting players that we've got on the pitch. Okay?
No! Exciting, yeah.
That was it. It wasn't exciting. Cut off. They were that music game at the end is people getting up to leave the room because the because it's over. I think it's just when you hear footage of team talk is involved, and it leads you to think of those old clips. There was a guy, I think, was he Leighton Orient or some guy in the 80s or 90s who like opens up on the entire dressing room, and you can bring your dinner as well if you want it or something, while going to war with some player. And any behind the scenes stuff, you sort of assume this is what you're going to get. Even in rugby, some of the Lions stuff or whatever, you see this passion play.
Yeah.
That just isn't really stirring the emotions very much. I mean, maybe it's unfair. Maybe we're going to hear the Lionheart speeches that he's going to give before Wales go to war.
The reason it's potentially unfair is they're still at the hotel at that stage. So they're in their suits. They're not studs on about to go out when maybe he's trying to raise them into some kind of emotional state. But that said, it's a bit of a downer.
But some managers like do their team meeting. They do a lot of their talking in their team meeting. Yeah. I once was in a hotel where I overheard Stephen Kenny give a team meeting to players, and it was a lively affair, shall we say. It was motivational. So like people pick their moments, and but he knew it was being recorded. I think this is the thing.
He was in the shop window.
This wasn't CCTV footage or like some lad sort of leaked it out. I mean, this was put out there as part of the persona.
Who knows? Maybe players just are so sick of the rabble rousing.
Well, Fergie, he said that Fergie was simple. They kept his messages simple. Wasn't that his whole thing? He probably had an intimidation factor, but he wasn't necessarily overloading people with information. There is an element of, well, you're good players, you can go out and beat them.
Yeah.
That can be the most confident inducing thing you can say to someone.
The Giggs message was, City or Liverpool are going to win the league, and something about the fans. And he's excited. That was kind of
like Phil Brown saying, you're going to catch me the next England manager's job here, whatever the line was.
I'm the next England manager. You can't play like that.
And that's inspiring. Yeah.
So Raphael Honigstein is good to go. He's recently written a book about Jurgen Klopp, Bring the Noise. And Rafa, I presume, like everyone, you went into Sunday's game with high expectations and the game fully delivered. I mean, it was pretty amazing stuff. Are we starting more and more to see the Klopp vision come to fruition here?
Yes. I think we're safe in saying that. I think the way he wants to play has been modified and perhaps tempered with a little bit over the course of the season in anticipation and perhaps in recognition of the demands of the Premier League. I don't think they are actually playing a similar game like that every single week. I think they've made it a little bit more flexible, but certainly against City, they basically continued where they left off for the first 20 minutes or so in the first game of the season, where they played them so well until Mane got sent off. And they showed that a well performed well, drilled pressing game can disrupt even the best passing side in Europe right now.
Not least because the best passing side will continue to try and pass the ball out from the back. And Liverpool, I mean, the one thing City don't have in that respect is any kind of unpredictability. And so it does leave them susceptible for a Jurgen Klopp ambush. And that has been the case between those two managers. Klopp's beaten Guardiola 5 times.
Yes, and it was interesting to see Guardiola stick to his principles. Of course, we'd like to think that Guardiola is ultra-dogmatic, but when he was at Bayern, the first game they played each other in the Bundesliga, Guardiola went to Dortmund and he played a real long ball game, and he put Javi Martinez up as a false number 10. So he put a defending midfielder up behind the striker to catch the second balls, and it was very ugly. And very
Guardiola,
very industrious. And then after sort of very attritional battle of for 70 minutes, then he brought on Mario Götze, he brought in a couple of small players, and then Bayern killed him. So I've seen Guardiola go long. I think the case with City right now is that they don't necessarily have the strikers up front to go long, because, you know, what is the use of going long with Aguero up there? So maybe that is something where he still feels that the squad perhaps needs to be tweaked a little bit to have that option in the future.
I'm curious with Klopp. He took over in Dortmund in 2008, and it was 3 years before he won the Bundesliga, 2011, 2012, and I suppose the real peak then, Champions League final 2013. So you're talking 4 to 5 years before he really had done something incredibly special at Dortmund. Does he feel like he's on a similar timeline at Liverpool?
Oh, I think he needs to be a bit quicker than that. I think in his third year, when they won the Bundesliga title, with a team that really nobody had anywhere near on the radar, they'd finished in fifth position the year before. Everybody thought, you know, if they finish fourth or third, that's good. But they won it, and they won it in a manner that blew the whole competition out of the water that time in 10-11, completely humiliated Bayern Munich, a Bayern Munich that had gone to the Champions League final the year before. And really, most teams were absolutely helpless against that kind of game. Now, time has moved on. In a way, he's been cursed by his own success, because a lot of teams in the Bundesliga adopted similar ways of playing, which then made it more difficult for Dortmund. And with Liverpool, I think he has to be a bit careful not to be too one-dimensional, because a lot of teams like to go long, to go bypass the press. And I think, crucially, what he has to learn is it doesn't actually make sense pressing against some of the smaller sides, because you're better off giving them the ball because they're not very good with it, and then just attack them from a little bit deeper and play a bit more on the break. I think that's what we've seen. I think that's one of the main reasons why they've had better results against the so-called smaller teams this year.
Mm. So I mentioned your book on Klopp, Bring the Noise. Not to overstate what you just said there and paint it as some kind of revolutionary performance by Dortmund, but certainly dramatic. Klopp and his relationship with Wolfgang Frank is very interesting. He played under Frank at Mainz. Frank is pretty much credited with bringing the 4-4-2 system to Germany. Is that right?
The flat back four, the zonal marking system. It sounds incredulous, but until the mid-90s, no one in the Bundesliga played a proper zonal marking game with a flat back four. Most teams had some version of a sweeper. Most teams had some version of man marking. So Wolfgang Frank was the first guy who really systematically introduced that, had a bit of success, because he saved Mainz from relegation in the second Bundesliga. And then in the very next season, for the very first time in Mainz's history, suddenly they were fighting for promotion. And Jurgen Klopp had an epiphany, because he had always assumed, like most Germans, that good teams won football games and bad teams lost football games. But these tactics, which were revolutionary at the time, certainly in the second Bundesliga, suddenly made Mainz win games, even though they were individually very, very poor. So he understood the importance of tactics, the importance of a system, and certainly the importance of innovation at the time. And then again, that came to the forefront with Dortmund, because even in 2011, when, of course, you know, playing with the back four and zonal marking is no longer a novelty, the kind of pressing, the concerted pressing from Dortmund, and then the gegenpressing, which is something that he was influenced by also from Pep Guardiola's Barcelona, the combination of those two things just suffocated teams and made it impossible almost for them to get any points.
That's a slightly confusing dynamic that you've painted there, in that the architects of modern day German football, like the guys who would have been shaping the late 80s, 90s, would have seen the Cruyff Revolution with the Dutch, and that the prevailing feeling was that good teams win matches over less good teams, and tactics really aren't overly important, and this is just how we do things. That seems, I'm surprised, really. I just would have presumed German football would have been far more progressive.
No, we weren't. I mean, there's a reason why the German national team only actually started playing with the back four in 2002. Up until then, they had a sweeper. And they were clearly left behind the times. And the German national team took longer, actually, than some of the Bundesliga, and certainly some of the Bundesliga 2 teams, to wake up to that modern development. But German football after the Second World War is a football of heroes. You know, you look to individuals to dominate games, to score hundreds of goals. You had your Gerd Müllers, you had a Franz Beckenbauer, you had Günter Netzer, Uwe Seeler. But if you were to ask sort of the ordinary German on the street, you know, what kind of system did they play, they'd probably struggle to tell you. So it was a very individualistic approach, also made popular and successful by Bayern Munich of the mid-70s, who had this amazing spine of players, but tactically weren't that exciting and certainly weren't that innovative. And we had that strange moment in the late 90s, early 2000s, when there was lots of innovation, but it was coming at places where nobody really looked, like Mainz, like Bochum, like Freiburg, whereas the big sides and the national team themselves were still stuck in the 70s, essentially, playing with a sweeper system.
Right. Is this one of the reasons Klopp was so popular when he started doing his punditry?
The reason why he was so popular as a pundit was because he could blend this charm and this wit that you see and the humor with real insight, insight that hadn't really been seen before. If you think back to sort of the years before we had Monday Night Football on Sky, before we had a Gary Neville really spending half an hour explaining how certain teams defend or how certain teams take corners, that kind of in-depth, kind of detailed analysis, it just didn't exist on German football. So you'd have the pundit, of course, but they would say something like, oh, this team can't deal with the pressure, or this team are arrogant, or this team, lack character. Mm. All these kind of morality explanations, or armchair psychology. But Klopp was the first guy in front of 80 million people, and most of them weren't even football fans, of course, tuning in, to say, you know what, this goal was scored because the right back is 20 meters in the wrong position. But he said it in a way that was entertaining, and people thought, oh yeah, that kind of makes sense. And suddenly the debate about football and the discourse changed, and I think he really had a big impact in making people think differently about football. And of course, if you think differently about football, you can also play differently.
And I mean, Rafa, how much was that a surprise to people, in line with it, the perception of Klopp as a player? Because I think we sometimes forget over here that, you know, this part of the world, that he was an ex-player in Germany. He would have been known, I presume he had a particular style of play when he was on the pitch. I mean, is this a very different persona of, you know, that they saw a completely different side to him once he moved into that line of work?
Yes and no. I mean, he was only ever a second division player, and he only ever played for Mainz, which is a team that, until he came there and had success as a coach, nobody really had heard of outside of Mainz. So they were your classic, unfashionable, nondescript club in the shadows of bigger sides, never going anywhere. He became sort of slightly famous in terms of having a cult following when one of the stations started broadcasting Second Bundesliga and made it a bit of a show and a bit of a spectacle. And he was always the guy who would give the interviews and come up with something interesting. But we're talking this is not mainstream. This is a very select group of people watching Second Bundesliga football. So in a way, it was a huge shock to the system that this guy then arrives in 2005 at the Confed Cup, who'd never played for Germany, who'd never even played in the Bundesliga, but is explaining the football of the German national team of Brazil in a studio with Franz Beckenbauer and Pele. So, you know, to pull that off, you had to have something quite substantial. And he managed to do it.
When were the Beckenbauers, maybe not him specifically, but there must have been a cohort of former great players saying, this is all tosh.
I mean, there was, this is also mentioned in the book, there was an incident in, I think it was, in 2001, when him and Ralf Rangnick, who was also a Maverick to a certain extent, but not quite as successful as Klopp as a coach, were both on a TV show with Paul Breitner, the 1974 World Cup winner. And Breitner actually initially refused to come on with the two of them because he said, why should I go on with two second division coaches? What do they know about German football?
Wow. Okay. I'd love to ask you more on how things are going for him at Liverpool. Unfortunately, we have to cut it short because Martin O'Neill has decided to speak to us at last about, just how keen he is to stay on as Ireland manager. But
I can't compete with that.
No, I dare say, though, we'll come back to Klopp and talk maybe a bit more about the Liverpool side of things.
Anytime.
Yeah, we'd love to. That's Raphael Honigstein, and Klopp, Bring the Noise is the book we're chatting to him about there, as well as the game. So... Dan, I'm being told that Martin O'Neill has addressed his contract situation in a video that the FAI, I hope they haven't given him a grillion, that the FAI have just posted on their official Twitter account.
Martin, can you give us an update on the contract situation?
Yeah, that's been resolved. John and I have agreed terms, and it's just a matter now of the lawyers looking over some sort of detail and getting it signed up.
It's an exciting year ahead. Next week we've got the Nations League draw. The end of the year, then we have the Euro 2020 qualifying draw. Exciting times ahead.
Yeah, I think that the European Nations draw is an interesting one. It's coming up very, very quickly, and obviously it's taking place now before the Euros in itself. So I think that not everyone is absolutely au fait with the type of ruling about it anyway. But suffice to say that these games are pretty important.
Is it a case now of focusing on the draw next week? And looking ahead to the Euro 2020 qualifiers then?
Yeah, I think first things first, obviously. I think that the draw, that'll be quite exciting for a start. And those games taking place then, obviously, at the start of next season, as it were. We've got a couple of friendly games coming up, and I think that might just be the time to maybe introduce some younger players who are pretty hungry, and let's see how that goes. Certainly, maybe even for the first game in March.
Well, I think that answers all the questions.
Well, it wasn't quite Frost Nixon, to be fair, you know, in terms
that,
of...
That takes care of everything. Grant, let's all move on.
Let's move along.
Exciting times.
To be fair...
I love, though...
The FBI employee is there with a job to do, and, you know, it's not their place to throw in the questions. Sorry, it's not fair on them, but...
I mean, still absolutely adore they still haven't signed it. I think that was like a subtle humorous nod. No, it's still a verbal agreement.
Cleared it all up.
That was always going to be what it was going to be.
Yeah, from the FBI, that doesn't classify as breaking your silence, by the way. That's not really it. You know, that's sort of a, listen, we've polished this one off. We'll put that one to bed anyway. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was that's on the official FAI video. I mean, I suppose we'll see what O'Neill has to say about. Is he talking tomorrow? Is that?
Oh, we don't know.
We don't know. No.
That came as a bit of a surprise to me. There's an event on tomorrow of which the details of which are embargoed until tomorrow morning, Joe.
Okay.
But there's an event on. It's a joint FEI IRFU event. So
is that the Aviva or something, isn't it? Or can you even say that?
Who knows?
Oh, well, I may have, but it's somewhere in Dublin.
Somewhere in Dublin.
And we don't quite know how it's going to work.
No, yet. We don't know at all. We don't know at all.
So he may speak, he may not.
He may not. That doesn't count as speaking. I mean, he physically used words. But in terms of clearing up the grey area.
He cleared up everything.
Not so much,
actually.
Yeah.
So that's the latest on Martin O'Neill. We'll say no more about it for the time being. We'll come back to Rafa. Loads of interesting stuff on Klopp there. And actually, in some respects, German football, we need to do more on that whole tactical war that broke out in the 90s.
Whole arc there, yeah, exactly, yeah.
I guess post-World War, it was about heroes. Is how it all worked. I mean, they did okay, German football for
they had the odd win
with heroes. So we'll take a short break. Miguel Delaney will join us. He's all over the Sanchez situation, it seems, going to Old Trafford.
Off the Ball,
in association with AIR. Don't miss live and exclusive Premier League action this month on the AIR Sport Pack.
This is News Talk.
You're very welcome back. So Miguel Delaney of the London Independent joins us to give us the latest on the Alexis Sanchez to Manchester United and Mkhitaryan, the opposite direction situation. Miguel, it seems Manchester United are pretty much nailed on to get Sanchez now at this stage.
I'd say it's en route to Old Trafford, but at a very attritional pace and around the pace that Raiola negotiations usually take. especially when this isn't his client's first option. I mean, what's come out today is that this whole deal is dependent on Mkhitaryan going to Arsenal. Now, I don't fully believe that. I from what I've been told, what I think is that even if the Mkhitaryan deal breaks down, it's too far along now, and Wenger wants Sanchez gone that much that even if the Mkhitaryan side breaks down, United will ultimately just pay the money. But this probably represents the best solution for both parties, given that Wenger wants a replacement and Mourinho wants a short squad and also isn't too enamoured with Mkhitaryan. So while that deal can be done, well, there's a possibility, but I think they will try and get it done. But it's moving very, very slowly, basically, because Mkhitaryan's first choice is to go to Borussia Dortmund. He's on about 180,000 a week at Old Trafford, from what we want. And Arsenal themselves are very tough negotiators. So this could yet take a few days.
Okay. Guardiola reportedly, and again, who knows what's been said publicly and privately, but walked away from the Sanchez deal because he believed the money had become too much. So what are the figures involved here? I know there's agents' fees, which is a big component. What do we know about the financial side of this deal?
Well, even from in terms of City, the deal they had struck back, well, actually, they renegotiated. First, I mean, they'd come to some sort of agreement in the summer before the bid that Arsenal first turned down and then were willing to do had they got Lamar, which they didn't. Then it was renegotiated to happen for January. And I think it was over 250,000 up to 300,000. More importantly, for Guardiola, anyway, not necessarily for City, he thought he had a player that was fully willing to buy into his approach and was enamoured of the idea of City and, you know, bought into the project, all the rest of it. So once it got to the point where suddenly, because of United's interest, the Sanchez side wanted to renegotiate the deal again, because of that principle, Guardiola was willing to walk away. And I think from City side, there's probably a few other elements to it. You know, in the summer, there was still maybe a few questions about how they'd start the season, about how much the squad understood the Guardiola approach. Now, then obviously they went on this incredible run. The attack was functioning so well. And suddenly the need for Sanchez was lessened. And given all of that, given his age, given the renegotiation, given what, I suppose, what they feel is kind of just this inconvenience with his representatives trying to renegotiate again, they walked away. But I suppose ultimately they walked away too because United came into this deal quite forcefully and made it very clear to Arsenal and to Sanchez's side very early on that they'd pay whatever they wanted. They're willing to meet the fee, and by all accounts they're willing to pay up to 400,000 a year.
Imagine
old money. I think.
Yeah.
What's your take on the Chelsea angle? I mean, I wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't never read too much into a manager's public denials. I mean, I know the story. You had the story yesterday. Is that just a classic case of sort of sniffing out what might be going on and in the background, just in case there may be a gap there they could exploit?
Yeah. I mean, and there was a perception last night that I saw that it came from the City side, but I didn't hear from the City side. I heard from two different sources basically that Chelsea had basically just through intermediaries trying to look to suss out the situation and what was going on. And I think had there been any sort of breakdown with United, you could have well have seen them act, but it was nowhere near as strong, say, as United coming in at this time last week. And it was too far down the line really for it to happen. I mean, there was Chelsea interest, despite what Conte said today, but not that strong. And it was never really going to derail this.
So if you throw in the £20 million signing on fee that United are willing to give to Sanchez personally, it seems his agent will get £10 million, which is just the most amazing work if you can get it. And you throw in his £400,000 a week. It kind of, and I think you were making the point in the London Indy, this kind of bumps it all up to about a £65 million outlay for Manchester United, which maybe, you know, Sanchez is 29 in today's market. At other times, he might get in excess of 100 million. So they probably look at 65 million and say, even though it's more expensive than it might have been first billed, this is a pretty good value for money.
Yeah, absolutely. And from that perspective, I think it's a bit of a no-brainer. As regards the agent fees, actually, on that, I think that's one of the reasons why Chelsea might have been reluctant or put off once even they sussed it out, because this is a club that, I mean, one reason that the Lukaku deal for Chelsea fell down last summer is because they don't want to pay such high agent fees. They're against it, and from what I've heard, they won't deal with Raiola. And City are kind of in a similar position. That they don't want to pay such high agencies. And I think United are quite unique in that regard and what they're willing to pay. And it is, it's an interesting inversion, I suppose, of recent history, given that now United, with all their tradition and their history, have almost become the team that have to put this money around to get these deals done. Although I suppose in both cases, it's kind of Trump, it's looking to hijack or Trump deals that were already in motion.
Yeah.
I know, for all of that, I think given the quality of the player, I do think it's a no-brainer for United, particularly given some of the issues. I think even from a football perspective, it does make a certain sense for Sanchez to go to United rather than City. I mean, for one, City's he'd be kind of just another great attacker in City's team. I mean, this is a player who always wants to play. You know, Wenger used to talk about how he would have to be careful, or else he wouldn't get into the red zone as regards injury. He would have been on the bench more than City. He'll be the main man at United. And secondly, like, I remember hearing a story from his time at Barca where Guardiola actually used to regularly get frustrated because, you know, his ideal of a player, or the Barca ideal, is someone that gets the ball, immediately stops it and looks up, whereas Sanchez's first instinct was to get the ball and basically head down and burrow forward. And I think that individualism almost kind of better suits Mourinho's more laissez-faire approach to attack. So I do think all of this makes sense. And yet, I think there are a few caveats. I mean, we've all seen these discussions about players who, especially athletic-based players, who kind of start their career at 16, 17, like Michael Owen, Wayne Rooney, and then or Fernando Torres, and then by kind of 29, 30, they're burning out a little. Sanchez has been playing that long. He's 29 now. You know, do you want to be in a situation where you're paying a 32-year-old who doesn't have the same legs, you know, this amount of money a week?
Yeah.
That
is the gamble. How well will Sanchez age is a slight question mark over him. As for Sanchez himself, I mean, our insight into his character is generally him being passive-aggressive to his Arsenal teammates on the pitch and waving his hands as he tries to passive-aggressively press the opposition. I've never seen someone almost have a go at his teammates by pressing the opposition on his own in a kind of sulky way and then turning around and saying, look at me and look at you. But away from the field, you wrote a piece on him last year. He's a fairly interesting character, seems to like London, the anonymity of London, enjoys playing his piano, doesn't necessarily go and attend the barbecues that other Chile teammates might organise around London. You might give us a bit more of a sense of the man behind that very angry face we sometimes see on the pitch.
Although, yes, often a very smiling face, particularly when he's with his dogs, that of course have become a bit of
I haven't seen this.
A source of interest. Adam and Humber, as they're called. I mean, I think he set up a separate Instagram account for his two dogs as well. And there was the Arsenal banner that in celebration at one point. But yeah, I think he's...
What was the Arsenal banner? Sorry.
I think it was just a big one of the two dogs.
It was pretty straightforward, Joe.
Okay, not quite as witty as I was hoping for.
Yeah. No, there was no message on it. It was just, you know,
just a picture of the two dogs.
Pictures of dogs.
Yeah, yeah.
There are no trigs, though, yeah, I think.
No, no. In fact, are they the most famous dogs in football since Triggs?
It'd be up there, I think, yeah.
That's a question. 53106. I'm sure that one will blow the text machine wide open.
Maybe another question. Yeah, but I think he is seen as a bit of a prickly character.
Right.
Not necessarily a diva, but more kind of knows his ability. So, some might even say he has a too much of an opinion of his own ability and kind of keeps himself to himself. I mean, I remember talking to someone who works with a lot of the South Americans that play in England. And it's even the Chilean international teammates who were at QPR and, you know, won a Copa America with Alexis Sanchez, should have a deep enough bond with him. And yeah, like they'd have barbecues and kind of get-togethers in London, and he had absolutely no interest in meeting up with them. Mm. And he, actually, in regard to that whole issue of kind of berating teammates, some Arsenal players by the end were, you know, just thought that was all for effect, didn't actually think he was working that hard himself. And it was even interesting, I've heard from colleagues who've kind of interviewed some Arsenal players recently, and this is something that rarely happens, particularly with players anymore. So, like, some of them were even willing to go off the record and kind of talk about how irritated they were with Sanchez.
Right. Okay.
So that's another side to his personality that Mourinho has to consider.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what could go wrong there with Mourinho there, not to douse flames on the whole thing? Does Sanchez go right into the Manchester United team? What does it mean for Lukaku? Or does Sanchez kind of play out wide?
He'd probably be out wide, I'd say. But it is an option. I mean, because I think one of the things that Mourinho has been conscious of is that he'd almost like more pressure on Lukaku, given Mourinho's general tough love approach. And I think, like, as Latan, as impressive as his comeback from injury is, he's clearly not yet, if ever, going to be this. He's not yet the same player that he was before the injury. So that they did have a problem there. I have to say, I mean, for all the debates about Mourinho and this, and I think there are fair debates, and his kind of style in the modern game, I do think this could be this could give United a real decent shot at the Champions League. Because, you know, it's Mourinho's, you know, tactical acumen, that kind of stable, solid defence, and then with the rampaging quality of someone like Sanchez, it could push them up a level.
Yeah, Miguel, I mean, you mentioned the fact that United, you know, pay these agents' fees. I mean, like, do you interpret that as an element of, I know it's only a point you're making in passing, but like, do you sort of take that as a degree of desperation in their business and trying to keep Mourinho happy? Is it about Mourinho himself and how he does business, that they are just now, they're doing whatever it takes to close that gap, that they are conscious they've got stuff to do?
Yeah, and I'd almost say it comes down to the structure of the club as much as Mourinho, although that probably suits Mourinho. I mean, he's someone that, in terms of his transfer dealings anyway, and I suppose his overall power to club, he's always wanted to be much more a Ferguson rather than kind of the continental approach. He wants to decide everything. He's, from what I've heard, he's always been resistant to the idea of a director of football, and he was certainly kind of, you know, he used to grouse at Chelsea. But if you look at that in general as well, and even with Arsenal, there's an interesting thing going on with Arsenal, and that obviously, much like Ferguson at United, everything at the club was built up to one man, which meant that the club almost had an old-fashioned structure, because what is built up towards one specific man isn't necessarily best practice in the modern game. But at Arsenal, actually, they've already been making changes to basically try and preempt this. I think they've had 11 backroom appointments since June. They've brought in this new head of scouting, Mislintat, from Dortmund. The Raul Senlehi is going to start as well. He's not strictly called a director of football while Wenger is there, but that will be pretty much his role.
Yeah,
he comes in at the start of February. And same with City, I mean, they probably have one of the most forward-thinking football structures in the world at the moment. Similarly, Chelsea, even though it's maybe a smaller operation in terms of personnel in that regard, you know, up until the last 2 years, they were, you know, the toughest negotiators in the game. Mourinho is widely respected. But United almost have the most old-fashioned structure of all those big six clubs now. And I think that is one of the reasons why they almost have to do what others don't and are willing to pay these massive fees to get some of these deals done.
Right. And is the short version of the situation regarding agents' fees that they seem to have gone up exponentially? I don't know if is it completely out of kilter with where they were 10 years ago or 15 years ago, even allowing for football inflation. But is the short version that they're just getting in there now? There's figures like Raiola and Mendes, they're super agents. They go to a club and they say, I can deliver you player X, but it's going to cost you Y. Take it or leave it. And is that basically how it's working out? They're just naming their own price, or is there some algorithm and they get a percentage of some kind of fee, or do we know how it's all working?
I suppose it's almost kind of a case by case basis. I mean, okay. I was doing research tonight for a piece on Raiola himself, and was reading that one of the things that came out of the football leaks was a clause he had written into one of his dealings with Mkhitaryan with Dortmund, in which he was trying to maneuver Mkhitaryan out of the club to Manchester United. But this was in Der Spiegel, and basically the clause had it that if Mkhitaryan actually stayed at Dortmund, they would have had to pay Raiola ostensibly for keeping him there.
Okay, so you can have my guy, you can have Mkhitaryan, but if he doesn't move and therefore I don't get the big signing on fee from a Manchester United, then you've got to compensate me for that if you want to keep him.
No, that was essentially how it worked out. Yeah.
Okay. This is brilliant stuff. So potentially Sanchez's agent, and we don't know what's going on necessarily, but it's just gone to United and say, yeah, look, I can help grease the wheels here for you guys if you're willing to give me 10 million. And may have said the same to Chelsea, or may have said the same to other clubs, and Manchester United said, yeah, we'll give you the 10 million. That is likely to have been the case?
I'm probably a bit more complex than that. But I suppose that's what ultimately boils down to. And when it comes right down to it, Chelsea and City are reluctant to pay those fees. City were very irritated at the sudden kind of moving of the goalposts and the idea that United's interest is being used to extract more money than they won't pay it, whereas United have made it clear they will.
Okay. We one last point. Our listeners told us in no uncertain terms last night not to bring this up again, but it would be remiss of us, seeing as you're over there and talking to people in the game on that side of the pond. What have you made of the whole Martin O'Neill situation?
I think I'm like many Irish people. I think in that, you know, just the feeling it had run its course, and as I suppose, I mean, basically both maybe from covering the for any time you cover the Irish team and the idea of kind of wanting something new, and both and as a fan, I just feel it was time. But interestingly, I think I mean a lot of this story watching from over here seems to be revolve around O'Neill's perceptions of himself, whereas interestingly here he's certainly not viewed the way he was in 1997 through, you know, through up to 2009 even. Because actually I was listening to one discussion, and this is when the, you know, everyone in Ireland was very much immersed in this talk about whether he would go. But there was one radio discussion here where it didn't even bring O'Neill into it. That's how little he was considered. It was seen as between Kike Sanchez-Flores and Rowett, and O'Neill was barely mentioned at the time.
He's in town tomorrow, so I think we'll hear what he says. Miguel, thanks so much for all that.
Cheers, thanks lads.
Herrera, what type of midfield is Herrera? He's not a box to box, he's not defensive, he can't do a killer pass. Why is he on the fucking pitch? What for? What? See him come here and fucking boss us at Old Trafford. This is Man United talking. See him come here and fucking boss us. Rojo, what has he? What was his tactics? As soon as you get Rojo, just fucking do it. We're not fucking Stoke. We're Man fucking United here. What? That was diabolical, that. Martial, he's playing against a fucking centre midfielder in doubt. Take the fucking on! Take him on and fucking do it! We're Man fucking United here! That was diabolical!
Off the ball.
In association with AIR. Don't miss live and exclusive Premier League action this month on the AIR Sport Pack.
This is News Talk.
Welcome back, Joe and Dan here. So that was Miguel Delaney before the break. And just if you didn't catch it earlier on, Martin O'Neill has broken his silence. He has spoken to FAI TV. It was put up on the official FAI Twitter feed. Just if you didn't catch it, we played the audio earlier on.
Mr. Burns, your campaign seems to have the momentum of a runaway freight train. Why are you so popular?
Ooh, a tough question, but a fair one.
Sorry, that's the wrong clip. Sorry, cut that. That's the wrong clip. Here is the Martin O'Neill FAI interview.
Martin, can you give us an update on the contract situation?
Yeah, that's been resolved. John and I have agreed terms, and it's just a matter now of the lawyers looking over some sort of detail and getting it signed up.
It's an exciting year ahead. Next week we've got the Nations League draw. The end of the year, then we have the Euro 2020 qualifying draw. Exciting times ahead.
Yeah, I think that the European Nations draw is an interesting one. It's coming up very, very quickly, and obviously it's taking place now before the Euros in itself. So I think that not everyone is absolutely au fait with the type of ruling about it anyway. But suffice to say that these games are pretty important.
Is it a case now of focusing on the draw next week and looking ahead to the Euro 2020 qualifiers then?
Yeah, I think first things first, obviously. I think that the draw, that'll be quite exciting for a start. And those games taking place then, obviously, at the start of next season, as it were. We've got a couple of friendly games coming up, and I think that might just be the time to maybe introduce some younger players who are pretty hungry, and let's see how that goes. Certainly, maybe even for the first game in March.
There we are.
That's a lot of rubbish. Yeah, I mean, like, and people aspire for a future where, like, you know, clubs and associations that control their own media, they think that would be a good way to sort of portray your message, and maybe it might work for them. But I think even the public are bored with this.
No, I think
that's a bit unsatisfactory.
No, that cleared it up for me, Dan. Leicester City 2-0 winners over Fleetwood this evening. Cardiff City beat Mansfield. This is all FA Cup.
A historic goal in that one as well. VAR for the first time, Iheanacho.
And it came in which game?
In the Leicester Fleetwood game.
Okay.
It was used to give the goal. Two great video moments tonight, that and the FAI clip.
Cardiff beat Mansfield 4-1, Sheffield Wednesday 2, Carlisle United 0, Reading beat Stevenage 3-0, and bloody West Ham are in extra time against Shrewsbury, 0-0 there. So we are out of time. The Tom Dunn Show is on the way next, 7:45 a.m. tomorrow, every weekday morning. Jer and Owen here for OTB AM, Periscope, Twitter, Facebook Live. Check out the Off the Ball Twitter feed. You'll get various links to the show there. And then we're back for the evening show, 7 o'clock here on the radio. It's going to the wireless, the radio. Got mixed somewhere in between. But we'll also be streaming live in the usual places. So we are done for this evening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.